We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning and happy Thursday. It is almost the end of the week, and we've been talking so much about the debate, which of course dominated the news, and rightly so, this week, that you may have missed a few other headlines. So in a fiery hearing exchange, according to this coming from Fox News, Cuomo admits, this is former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, admits he never consulted health officials on his nursing home directive. So he was very belligerent, is how I would characterize it, in this hearing, and really didn't admit anything. I'm not sure that some of these hearings are ever productive, but Representative Elise Stefanik said this: after months of inquiry and investigation, we now know irrefutable what New Yorkers have known for years, that Governor Cuomo himself and his most senior aides ordered, directed, and executed this deadly executive order counter to CMS and CDC guidance. So here is one exchange when Cuomo is actually admitting that he never talked to the CDC. He never really consulted any of the, you know, so-called experts. I'm not sure if I would characterize CDC really as the expert, but that he never really questioned anybody about what he was doing during that whole nursing home disaster, if you recall that, out of New York in 2020. Here's Cuomo.
My question was, did you ever speak with anyone, you, Governor Cuomo, did you ever speak with anyone at CMS or CDC about the directive beforehand? You, Governor Cuomo.
You asked that question, and I answered the question, and I said no.
Did you or not?
I said no. I answered the question.
Okay, thank you. Not even after, correct?
I said yes, and they never called me after. You would think if they had a problem with the directive, they would have called. If it was so outrageous,
you didn't even call to ensure that you were what you were declaring was accurate. Yes or no?
I don't know if the Department of Health
did you, Governor Cuomo. Right now, I'm talking to you, Governor Cuomo. Did you even attempt to ensure that what you were declaring was accurate? I'm asking you.
Yes,
I don't want to hear about anyone else.
Okay. Department of Health issued 400 advisories, several per day. I did not speak CMS about 400 advisories.
Thank you. In fact, no one we interviewed said they consulted with them to ensure the applicable science was being followed.
Well, let's welcome in Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who is a Stanford law professor, and you will recall he was one of the plaintiffs in the litigation outflowing the Twitter files and the censorship for posting opinions on COVID during all of this, and was also one that was an advocate during 2020 about other methods besides shutdowns, and we always appreciate his perspectives on this. So, Jay, good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining on this really important topic. So so this just seems like a typical, standard, frustrating congressional hearing that Cuomo is just not admitting anything. He's not taking responsibility for anything. What did you make of these hearings? And I mean, was there anything really learned or could be advanced legislatively in this context?
I mean, it was actually weirdly interesting. So first, it was appropriate that Congress hold a hearing on this. The what Governor Cuomo and his Department of Health did was shocking. Right, they sent COVID infected patients to the most place where the most vulnerable people lived, into nursing homes, when it was pretty well known, even by the time, that it was older people that had, were most vulnerable, I think, from dying from COVID infection. This is in the early days, and it partly explains why New York City or New York had such high death rates so early, because you know they chose exactly the wrong policy. There's a couple of things. One is that I think that it wasn't just New York that did this. You know, Michigan Governor Whitmer did this. This happened in California, a whole bunch of Pennsylvania. So this happened in several places around the country. The second thing, that exchange was really interesting because it highlighted the fact that it tried to highlight the fact that Governor Cuomo was somehow acting alone. But I actually think that line of questioning was a little bit misleading. In fact, Governor Cuomo is acting at the advice of his Department of Public Health. And the question is why? Why did the Department of Public Health tell him to do that? Why would they help advise him to issue such an order? Not every governor in the country issued such an order, and Governor Cuomo did, so he has to take responsibility for that. But the question is, why would he do that? And the answer to that question is that public health departments everywhere had the wrong goal, Jenna. Their goal seemed to be to open up spaces in hospital beds, anticipating a surge of COVID patients, rather than protecting vulnerable older people, which should have been the goal. When you have the wrong goal, you end up doing the wrong thing. And this wrong thing ended up killing many, many people who otherwise would have survived that first wave.
And that's such an important point, is that it wasn't just the political goals of the top level executives, the governors of these states that primarily blue states that ended up having some of these directives, and especially there in New York. And so what do we know about the public health departments and what their goals actually were, so that we can hopefully learn from this and prevent this type of disaster from ever happening again?
I mean, the tragedy is these public health departments, I think they were trying to do good. The problem is that they had fallen into this sort of groupthink mentality that excluded outside voices that would have, that if they'd listened to them, you know, people like Professor Martin Kulldorff of Harvard University were yelling as loud as they could, you know, basically ignored by the press and elsewhere, saying, look, it's older people that are the most vulnerable. You have to adopt policies that protect older people. Instead, these states, many states everywhere, decided that the only way, the biggest threat was overcrowding of hospitals. It's the irony is that in New York, there were large overflow hospital centers, like in the Javits Center, was converted into a makeshift hospital. President Trump sent the Mercy ship, a U.S. hospital ship. Those resources largely went unused when the surge was happening. Those might have been used to house some of the patients that were then sent to, you know, COVID-infected patients that were sent back to nursing homes. Instead, they were left unused in order to keep hospital beds open. The public health establishment is primarily to blame, I believe, rather than Governor Cuomo, although I do think he shares some of the blame. The problem is that they didn't allow themselves to listen to outside voices that were saying, don't focus just on hospital beds. That's too narrow a focus. Focus instead on protecting human life. And you do that by protecting the vulnerable.
Yeah, and it makes a lot more sense. And it was very frustrating in the midst of all that to see that it was so one-sided, and voices like yours as well, and Dr. Atlas, and you know, so many others that were very prominent during that time that were suggesting other routes and other solutions were basically just completely shut down and ignored in favor of some of these policies. And it was very fascinating to me as well, speaking of the debate, that the entire COVID fallout that the Trump administration bears some responsibility for. And of course, the Biden-Harris administration bears responsibility for their reaction once they were inaugurated, that was not a question at the debate. And do you think that that's because, you know, ABC and the moderators just don't want to go there, or maybe both candidates in this sense, both Trump and Harris, don't really want to defend their record on this?
I think both are true. Both are true. So there was a very, very brief and telling exchange, or a very interesting exchange, I should say, during the debate, where President Trump defended his handling of the pandemic in 2020, saying that, look, he had used the power of the federal government to requisition ventilators and masks. And then Vice President Harris responded with the point that the Chinese had hidden the origin of the virus. Both points are true, but it's so misleading in both of them. So, for instance, President Trump, he did requisition ventilators, but it turns out that ventilators, the overuse of them early in the pandemic, very likely caused excess deaths. If they had not used ventilators in the way they had early in the pandemic, many people, again, would have survived the first wave that didn't. Now, again, it's hard to blame someone like President Trump for this. This was what the public health authorities were telling him. Oh, we need to have ventilators. We're going to run short on ventilators. The public health authority had overreacted rather than treating the respiratory pneumonia like a normal respiratory pneumonia. They thought it was something unique and different, so different that it warranted the overuse of ventilators. I think public health authorities are the key thing. I think President Trump, rather than bragging about how well he did in 2020, he could have taken credit for some of the things that he did, but he instead should have turned around and pointed out that the Biden administration, with Vice President Harris certainly responsible, used the vaccine in a way that undermined trust in public health. The vaccine mandates, something that didn't come up during the debate, which should have, a black mark on the record of Vice President Harris and President Biden. I know for a fact, for instance, that Vice President Harris's campaign staff are still required to have the vaccine, even though there's no evidence at all that the vaccine stops you from getting and spreading COVID. It's an absolutely anti-scientific, anti-public health kind of measure, and yet her campaign staff are required to have it as the job measure. So it was frustrating to the nature of the debate. And then the other thing, Jenna, is that there were three groups represented in that debate: President Trump, Vice President Harris, and then also the media. The media failed during COVID. So in a sense, you're absolutely right. The media failed by fear-mongering, by emphasizing anti-science ideas, like the idea that the vaccine stops you from getting and spreading COVID, and then suppressing the criticism of those ideas. It's no wonder that none of the three really wanted to spend very much time on COVID. All three, in some sense, failed in fundamental ways. So it was frustrating to listen to.
It really was. And I'm speaking with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's a Stanford law professor. And it really was frustrating to listen to, not just on that front, but I think across the board on a lot of topics. And that's a very, very important point to underscore the different groups that were represented there, because the moderators did represent the media in a sense. I mean, they, and I don't even like to call them moderators, they were activists there, and clearly with some of their input. But just in the last few minutes that I have with you this morning, Jay, so where are we at now, you know, four plus years later, in terms of actually changing the perception of the media narratives and actually putting in place some better safeguards so that these types of just reliance on the so-called experts and all of these things don't happen again, when it seems like there's just no accountability and all of these special interest groups are trying to just memory hole what happened when it really wasn't that long ago. And we need to have some of these guardrails up so that the Constitution can't just be suspended at a whim, which thankfully the Supreme Court has acknowledged, but it really was in the midst of COVID, and it shouldn't ever happen again.
It's mixed, Jenna. So there's been a lot of movement on states to strengthen some of the safeguards or to establish safeguards. So the public health can't have this sort of almost endless power to like issue a state of emergency. But there hasn't been a political rebuke of the COVID decision-making, not yet. And as a result, I think the public health establishment still hasn't really acknowledged the catastrophic mistakes that they made. The closest that's come, and it is actually a source for hope, is that the embrace by President Trump of RFK Jr.'s platform, which includes fundamental transformation of public health authorities so that it is more evidence-based, and it does have more restrictions in its ability to issue, sort of emergency powers. That is actually a source for hope, and we'll see how the President Trump uses that in coming days. If he actually makes it into a political issue, it would be really interesting to really allow the American people to vote as a whole on the COVID the power of public health. Should be a central issue in the election, and I hope it's that President Trump starts to highlight it, because the contrast between the vision of public health of Vice President Harris, which is basically the COVID response, authoritarian power, control of free speech, versus some of the vision articulated by Prince RFK Jr., it couldn't be more stark.
Yeah, and I agree with you that I am very hopeful that now that RFK Jr. is an advisor to the Trump campaign and has endorsed President Trump, and there is this discussion about hopefully bettering overall public health, that with some of those ideas that RFK Jr. has been really hitting on for the last several years, that he could be helpful in that regard. And I hope to see more prominently that displayed. And there should be a policy. I mean, just like how the Trump campaign put out their bill of digital rights and, some of these things, because the American public are so concerned about censorship, about online platforms, about the public square, the First Amendment. We also need to be concerned about some of these public health issues like this. And I would love to see the Trump campaign, like you said, Jay, to make this an issue and to say, here is our platform and the vision of what exactly and precisely we're going to do. Because Harris has so many just vague platitudes, and her campaign's running on joy, which, that's not really a policy. That's not even really a value. It's a vagary, and it's nothing. And so the Trump campaign could really use this to benefit the discussion. So always really appreciate your time, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. You can follow him, and you should, on social media, because thankfully Elon allows these types of free discussions on X. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If ending babies' lives in their mother's womb isn't heartbreaking enough, the Biden-Harris administration punishes those who protect life, including up to 10 years in jail. In a shocking stance, the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, supports infanticide, meaning the death of newborns. When will this madness end? Preborn's network of clinics is positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country, on standby to protect and love mothers facing unplanned pregnancies. By introducing a woman to her baby through ultrasound and showering her with God's love, her baby's chance at life doubles. But they can't do it without our help. If you are pro-life, please consider a donation of any size to support the mission of Preborn. All gifts are tax deductible and will help defend the defenseless. One ultrasound is just $28, or five ultrasounds is $140. $5,000 will sponsor ultrasounds for Preborn's entire network for a full day. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR, preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And so where do we go from here post-debate? We're kind of seeing, you know, the polls haven't really changed that much. Of course, the divided camps are saying, you know, the Trump camp is saying that he just totally won, and Harris's camp is saying that she totally won. And I think that the media completely lost. That was the big takeaway, was that ABC should never have been allowed to facilitate that debate, because they were activists. They were not moderators. And that should have been an even bigger story. And I would have loved it personally if Donald Trump had just interrupted them and said, you know, something like, you know, until we can actually negotiate some good rules here and some ground rules and actually have this as a debate, I'm happy, Vice President Harris, to meet you back anytime. But that, you know, this is a completely rigged debate, and just walked off. I mean, that would have been more than the story if he had directed that toward the moderators and just said, you know, I'm happy to talk to you one on one, but this is ridiculous. So, I mean, that's my take. And I think that it was so ridiculous that his campaign was willing to go into that type of a setting when it should have been negotiated better. But could it have ever been? You know, I don't know. And then you're seeing the other news that in the midst of all of this and in the debate, there are very controversial figures like Laura Loomer, who some of you may not be aware of, who is a 9/11 conspiracy theorist who actually attended the memorial service with President Trump yesterday, was on the plane with him at the debate. And people on social media are saying, you know, this is exactly what we're talking about, that these type of individuals who are now around President Trump are not giving him good advice. And I agree with that. But let's see what my next guest has to say. Let's welcome in Aaron McIntyre, who's a producer for The Steve Dace Show and one of our favorites in terms of his perspectives and commentary. So, Aaron, did you watch the full debate? And if so, I am so sorry.
Hey, good morning, Jenna. Yeah, I did watch the entire debate, and I agree with your assessment. I mean, it was just absolutely nauseating. I felt sick watching that. I don't know if you're David Muir on a human level, how you come back from something like that. I guess his job is just so good that the pay is just so good that maybe that makes the spoonful of sugar makes everything go down. But I agree, that was absolutely nauseating. But I also agree that, you know, it is time to look forward. And there are a number of things that, just as you were saying, Donald Trump could have done, even 3-on-1 during that debate. I don't think it lost him the election, but it was an opportunity for him to win. And I don't think he took that opportunity. So going forward, I think his job is harder now. And if he's surrounded by individuals like Laura Loomer, I really do not like his prospects really that much at all in November. But overall, the environment right now, for every point that I could say is pro-Trump, I can think of another counterpoint to say I'm not so certain. I mean, the overall environment right now, it should be absolutely, just from a reactionary standpoint, the overall environment right now should be pro-Republican. But you look basically across the board, at least in swing states, Donald Trump is actually pulling way ahead of congressional candidates in swing states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, even Arizona, pulling way ahead of the gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina. Those are some really, really alarming signs. At the same time, though, I can see voter registration trends in places like Pennsylvania, places like Arizona, are positive for Republicans as well. But this should overall be a really, just from a reactionary standpoint, when you look at inflation, when you look at all of the maladies that our country has faced over the past 4 years, just from a reactionary standpoint, voters should be saying, whoever's in charge right now, absolutely not. They need to go. But it's just really not that environment that I see right now. So in terms of the overall environment as well, you know, the debate, it drew 67 million viewers. So that's more than the Biden-Trump debate from last June. But it's a lot less than the 2016 debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. That one drew 84 million viewers. The 2020 first presidential, maybe it was the second presidential debate between Biden and Trump, that drew 70-some million viewers. So I think in terms of the overall environment, one thing I am confident in saying is that people are more checked out this cycle than they have been the last two cycles. Now, that's incongruent, at least in 2020, with the number of people who actually supposedly voted in 2020. But I am pretty confident in saying that there are a lot of people who are just exhausted and checked out. What that means for the result, I do not know, but I'm pretty confident in saying that.
Yeah, and that to me is so fascinating, Aaron, on a number of levels. I mean, first, I agree with you that Trump really missed some opportunities. I mean, even if it's 3-on-1, I mean, I've seen him in the press briefing room when he was in the White House when it was like 27-on-1 and he held his own. I mean, this isn't 3-on-1, shouldn't have been a big deal for him. And yet he allowed it to be framed as if he's the incumbent and he's defending his record. And Kamala Harris hasn't had to defend her record of over the last 4 years. And that was kind of my main takeaway, was why was this the scenario where he's having to defend this as if he's the incumbent, instead of showing persistently and consistently the worldview of Kamala Harris? And so that then circles back to what you just said about how just checked out a lot of people are. And it's surprising in a sense, because even with all of the exhaustion, you know, maybe even Trump fatigue and just political fatigue in general, there is a serious concern from almost everybody that I hear from all the time. I mean, across the political spectrum, there is a concern over the future of America. So you would think that more people would be concerned about this election than they were even about 2020, when the focus was on, you know, some of the COVID response, some of those things, and there was a different sort of Trump fatigue. But it's really interesting that people aren't as checked, as dialed in. They're more checked out. And could it be, and I hope that this is actually what it is that they're maybe checked out of politics, but they're going to end up voting their values. I mean, do we have any sort of polling or, you know, any kind of measurement on maybe there's a suppression of enthusiasm, but there still is, hopefully, that type of turnout will be possible in terms of the overall concern about issues like the border and the economy that I think are the one and two issues?
Yeah, we won't know for sure the answer. You know, your listeners know this as well. We won't know for sure the answer to that question until November 6th. Whenever election season is over, we will know the answer to that question.
I think December or something.
Yeah. No, one thing that's really, really alarming to me, Gallup has been a fairly accurate pollster just on snapshots of the American pulse. A couple of weeks ago, they came out with their overall voter enthusiasm numbers. And Democrats have voter enthusiasm at 2008 levels, if you believe Gallup. Again, if you believe Gallup, that should be pretty concerning. That's absolutely incongruent, though, with all of the polling that we've seen out of most of the swing states, the most important states, where Donald Trump is at least neck and neck with Kamala Harris or leading her. In fact, after the Democrat National Convention, it just boggles the mind that we didn't even see much of an inflated or artificial boost from the DNC. So that's another thing that you'll kind of see a recurring theme in my analysis of this, just kind of a lot of disconcerting signals all over the place. I will say, though, that Donald Trump, after the DNC, his campaign has actually been a campaign other than the one flap over Amendment 4 in Florida, which he quickly corrected to his and his campaign's credit. It has been an actual campaign. They're staying, for the most part, on message. But yeah, going back to the debate, even 3-on-1, I thought from about the 20-25 minute mark in, when it became clear, and I think it became clear to Donald Trump too, that it actually was 3-on-1, he should have changed his name. He should have changed every answer to "your supporters almost shot me in the head," or "you let 20 plus million illegals into this country," or "you had 3.5 years to do this. Why haven't you done it?" He should have pivoted to that, or, as you said, just interrupted, walked off the stage and said, "This is not a serious debate. Catch me again if you want to talk serious issues." But there are a number of things, and this is kind of the main thing. Every time I look at Nate Silver's forecast, I get optimistic. Now, he hasn't been as right as he was back in, 2012, predicting, I think it was Obama versus Romney.
but he has said he's made tweaks and things of that nature. Every time I look at a forecast like that, every time I look at a crystal ball from respected venerable pollsters, and I start to get optimistic when it comes to Donald Trump's, or at least anti-communist prospects in November, Jenna, I keep thinking back to one thing, and it's a fact, 2022, the midterms happened. That is a fact. That is a real thing that happened. I was expecting not a red wave. I was expecting a red tsunami, and it really just never materialized. And so I'm not going to allow myself to get any atom of complacency when it comes to this election. And Jenna, you know me, I am the most reluctant Trump voter, possibly in this country. And when they tried to kill him on that stage, I realized something. This country is just running out of time. I pray that there are a number of people, enough people out there, who recognize the same thing, that we just cannot, and I know this sounds like a tired old GOP talking point trope, there's a morsel of truth we just cannot afford. And I'm not talking in dollars and cents. I'm talking about the amount of time this country has for opportunities to turn it around. We just cannot afford a Kamala Walls presidency. I'm stuck at the point now where I try to look at all these data signals, and there's just a lot of disconcerting things, incongruent things. When you look at Gallup, what I just talked about, and voter enthusiasm versus the actual polling on the ground, I don't know what to make of it. I'm just hoping that enough Americans have said, we cannot do this. And I'm just afraid we're not going to be able to know the answer to that question for sure until November 5th. We are going to get answers. We are going to get answers to some of these meta questions that we have about this country. And some of them might not be good answers, but we will get answers nonetheless. This will be the most clarifying election in American history.
I'm speaking with Aaron McIntyre, who is a producer for The Steve Dace Show, which is one of the best shows on streaming right now, and it's on The Blaze. And I just always appreciate the biblical worldview commentary, the discussions, and because this really does boil down to a theological question and also an existential question of, you know, what do we believe this nation should be, and what do we believe about the legitimacy of government and who we are as human beings made in God's image, and where do we go from here? And it is so easy because the issues are so complex, and the two candidates are so personally controversial in very different ways. And, you know, there's a lot of love and hate for both of them personally and individually. And, you know, there are so many different ways you can do this. But I think you're absolutely right, Aaron, that it boils down to whether or not we want this country to persist in freedom and liberty genuinely, or whether the Kamala Harris extreme leftist Democrat Marxist communist model will transform the country into something different. And that, if we can boil it down to a single issue, it's, do we want to keep our constitutional republic? If you can keep it, is what Benjamin Franklin very famously said. We have a republic. If we can keep it, will we keep it, or will we allow America to be transformed? And I was actually speaking to a friend last night, you know, kind of debate fallout related, who was saying, you know, literally he's thinking about moving from the country, you know, regardless of who wins, because the Overton window has shifted. We're seeing that the majority of the population is not even pro-life in a sense of not wanting abortion at all. I mean, you know, so many of these things are genuinely to the left that I fear for the future of this country. So just in the last 2 minutes that I have with you, Aaron, how important is it for the Trump campaign somehow to communicate that message that we just don't know how much time left this country has? And if, you know, God willing, we can persist and keep our constitutional republic, we will continue for ourselves and our posterity. But that really is, without just the fear-mongering and all of that, that really is the main message, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jenna. And ultimately, every meta argument, what's meta? That's big picture argument. Every big picture argument, who are we as a people? Where are we going? What are the values that we
that we agree upon to hold dear as a people. Every single big picture argument comes down to one question. Who is God? And the answer to that question, either God is or God isn't. Now, I'm not saying that Donald Trump is going to be necessarily the pastor in chief here, but he's somebody who doesn't hate people like you and me. I'm not convinced of that. He doesn't hate people like you and me. He will listen to us. He listens to people like us on Amendment 4. There were enough people in enough places around Donald Trump to pressure him to do the right thing on Amendment 4. And just very briefly, a quick anecdote out of my home state of Iowa. Back in, I think it was 2018, Kim Reynolds, our now governor, was lieutenant governor under Terry Branstad, who went to become and serve as the Chinese ambassador under the Trump administration. She was running for election. It was really re-election since she took over for Branstad after he left. She was not looking super rosy in the polls down the final stretch of that election. What did she do? I think she had a spiritual conversion, really, is my personal thing. But in terms of electoral politics, she absolutely leaned into her base. The Christian talk and teaching radio station here in central Iowa, which is a major metropolitan area, Des Moines is in Iowa. She was on that multiple times a week. She recognized that her base, her pro-life conservative Americans, Iowans, were her strength. If I were advising Donald Trump, I would do everything I possibly can to lean into his base. He's trying to, well, at least before Amendment 4, it seemed like he was trying to win without pro-lifers. Ride or die with your base. Lean into conservative Americans who love the Constitution, who love life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Ride or die with your base.
Amen to that. And I hope that that Trump is listening to that. And I think that there are a lot of people that that would agree with that, and especially the wide swath of evangelicals. That he needs. And if all of the evangelical Christians would get out and actually vote for him, then we would see a transformation in this country. And if they would just get out and vote their values, and he needs to recognize that. And I think with Evangelicals for Harris, they're trying to say, you know, if evangelicals would all just get out and vote for her, then she would win. You know, so evangelicals are a very important base. And I really, really hope that the Trump campaign really understands that, how important people who vote on truth really are to this nation. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's turn to something that we often don't cover here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning, which is sports. But this is actually an important incident. You may have heard about Tyreek Hill, who is a Miami Dolphins football player, and the incident that happened in Miami over the weekend when he was pulled over by Miami police. And there is body cam video from the police, and I am told by my great producer Devin that he watched the entire thing, and you should watch the entire thing of this interaction. And so Tyreek Hill has now, according to the New York Post, admits that he could have been better, but the cops who actually were beating him, and he is a black man, but the cops were I believe it was Cuban, and so this isn't really as much in the media in terms of the left harnessing this, because, you know, it wasn't, the cops weren't white. And let's just be honest about that. If that was the different scenario, then we would have all kinds of, you know, different narratives coming out of this. And this is why, you know, one of the reasons that all of you should go this weekend and see Matt Walsh's new movie, Am I Racist? Go to amiracist.com. And it's just an excellent, excellent movie that talks about how the left is purposefully attempting to race bait and to just continue to divide people. But in terms of what actually happened in this body cam video, let's welcome in my next guest, Rick Otazu, who is the host of the podcast Full Press Hockey and the former owner of JCW Wrestling. So good morning, Rick. And, you know, kind of give us the background of this a little bit in more detail of what exactly happened and what the controversy is.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. Plain and simple, there was a traffic stop taking place where the speed was estimated to be approximately 90 miles an hour in front of the stadium. The driver, Tyreek Hill, shot past two motorcycle police officers who were on detail in front of the stadium, who immediately put their lights on and pulled the car over. When the car was pulled over, the windows, which some of the facts that have not really been spoken about, were the windows were illegally tinted. The officers could not see inside the vehicle, hence why he was banging on the window, asking for the windows to be opened. It's a very dangerous situation. Obviously, any traffic stop in America can become dangerous at any second. But when you cannot see into the car, it makes it a little bit more difficult. The officer proceeded, and I'm glad people have finally got to see the body cam footage, because I call this the ultimate media manipulation. When just the initial footage came out and you saw officers with somebody on the ground, and it kind of looked very suspect. But after you've gotten a few minutes of seeing the footage and hearing the audio, Tyreek Hill did not cooperate at all in this traffic stop. And he's been called out in the media by several people, and it's really something that needs to be spoken about. You cannot put an officer in a situation where he cannot see your hands, or put an officer in a situation where you're directly refusing to abide by the simplest command of open your window.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just a basic 101 that that everybody in this country should know, that if you are pulled over, you need to cooperate and comply with police and not escalate the situation. And so, you know, initially when this came out, Tyreek Hill was calling for the firing of police officers after the traffic stop, and because he was detained, and there was, there was obviously an escalation there. But this is why body cams are also important. And so, where were we in terms of the initial, the initial projections and what people were saying about it compared to now after seeing the full body cam?
Well, one of the points I want to bring up is, Tyreek Hill admits to not being the best person when he was pulled over. And now in his press conference yesterday, he came up and he mocked the reporter who asked, your agent, Drew Rosenhaus, and you have asked for the termination of the officer. And his answer was, got to go. He's got to go. And he said it multiple times, and he was flailing his arms around in a very weird manner at the podium. This is just, to me, something where it could have been over in 30 seconds. It could have been, okay, officer, here's my driver's license. I'm sorry, I was speeding. He admitted to speeding. As a matter of fact, he said, just give me my ticket and let me get out of here. He admits to the guilt. He refuses to open the window. He refuses to comply with handing over the license. At that point, Officer Torres, a 27-year veteran of the force, also three times asked, step out of the vehicle. At this point, you have to put yourself in a police officer's shoes and say, everything he has asked to happen has not happened in a city where violence is known. I'm not saying Tyreek Hill is violent whatsoever. I'm not insinuating that. But there is a history of violence in that city. He cannot see a person's hands. The person is being disobedient during a traffic stop. And he had to do what he had to do to keep himself and other people safe at that moment, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you on that front, because you never know as a police officer what you are encountering. And we see a lot of these situations that are reported in the media. I saw a lot of things as a former prosecutor in the state of Colorado, how a simple traffic stop can escalate. And officers always have to be aware of officer safety. And so, so the reason for his noncompliance just seems like it was almost belligerent, and then he blames the officers for taking the situation very seriously. Do you think that this is one of the situations, Rick, that there is some fault on both sides? I mean, were the police officers, at least on the body cam, did they escalate appropriately, or is this a situation where it got out of hand? Because then, sometimes, the officers can be angry, and they can use their authority in ways that are across the line, and it's always really hard, because these situations happen so fast. I mean, and even in the context of a courtroom, whether it's on the prosecutor's side and the cop side or the defendant's side, so often it's so clinical as we're analyzing it right now or in a courtroom. When the situation on the ground happens so fast, you have to make these kind of snap decisions and judgment calls.
A split second in a police officer's life can save himself or multiple people in the area. Again, you have no idea what could have been in that vehicle. You have no idea why this person is resisting a simple command. Do I feel that there was a little bit of excessiveness on the police officer's part? I do, but I don't feel it was excessive until he was handcuffed and asked to sit himself down because of his surgically repaired knee. At that point, there was really no need for the officers to force him into a sitting position. I 100% would agree that at that point, the situation had been handled. He had been cuffed. He had been taken to the ground. He was helped up and then forced, very forcibly, if you watch the video, into a sitting position after he acknowledged that he did have a knee injury, just had surgery on that knee, and asked if he could just sit himself down. So, yes, I think tempers flared on both sides. I think the situation elevated really quickly. It could have been diffused a little faster than what it was, and it wasn't. But you also have to go into the police officer is now taken off duty. There's a full investigation of himself and everyone else that was involved on the police side. My problem is Tyreek Hill goes out and has a 130-yard game, including a 70-yard touchdown, and then mocks the police with a handcuff gesture on the field on national TV and doesn't take the situation serious. This is not a role model. This is not somebody who should be saying, I messed up. Okay, I was speeding is what he said. Okay, you're admitting guilt. I refuse to roll my window down. You're admitting guilt. I refuse to give my driver's license. You're admitting guilt. Then you're mocking the police on a national stage, and then you're calling for the officer to be fired. This, to me, is disturbing.
And that's such a great point, that there is a disparity in how, for example, the NFL is treating this situation versus the Miami Police Department. And this is a great example of a bad example of how you don't interact with cops. And, you know, and again, Matt Walsh has been posting about this, where the one post that I saw that I thought was great, where he said, RIP Tyreek Hill, he suffered a briefly unpleasant interaction with police that was entirely his own fault. I'm devastated. And all he has to comfort him is his $30 million a year salary. This is what black men have to deal with in our country. Outrageous. And then he goes on to say in a different post, 100% the fault of Tyreek Hill. He was pulled over for speeding instead of just cooperating like a normal person. He acted like a belligerent person. I won't repeat that word that Matt Walsh actually used on Christian radio, and then rolled up his tinted windows while the cop was talking to him. He's not a martyr. He's a grown man behaving like a spoiled toddler. And unfortunately, you know, this is what a lot of these celebrities, that type of entitlement. And I don't think that this is all about at all about race, about gender, about, you know, anything that the left often tries to make these types of interactions. It's just about somebody who's very entitled, thinking, you know, why do I have to cooperate even when I did something wrong? So in your view, Rick, should the NFL handle these types of situations differently?
I believe the NFL is the most lenient league in the history of professional sports. I believe the NFL allows known felons to take place in games. I believe they look the other way. There's situations with a player named Alvin Kamara a few years ago, where he attacked a gentleman in an elevator for simply stepping into an elevator in Las Vegas. They allow the players to dictate almost the thug lifestyle in the NFL. And it's really not something that a company that's worth billions and billions of dollars and it's expanding into Europe and expanding into South America, it's not a good look. As a person who's coached competitive sports for going on 30 years, how do I tell one of my kids that Tyreek Hill is innocent in this? How do I tell a young kid when he says to me, and this happened this week, how do I say to a kid who came up to me and was like, did you see what the cops did to Tyreek Hill? That was disgusting. No, I think you need to learn the facts. Let me explain something to you. And let me tell you how to put yourself in a safer situation. The NFL is way too lenient. There should have been a massive fine, at least a massive fine directed towards him for the celebration with the handcuffs. I think they didn't learn their lesson with Colin Kaepernick a few years ago. I think that the disrespect towards the police in a league where your players are basically once a week, someone is getting arrested, needs to come forth. I think the NFL needs to show support to the police and the military on a better level than what they have in the last 10 years. And to me, it's getting to a point where it's almost getting hard for me to watch games if you're going to continue to disrespect the people that are put out there to keep you safe.
Yeah, really well said, and I completely agree with you. Rick Otazu, who is the host of Full Press Hockey and former owner of JCW Wrestling, I really appreciate your insights and commentary, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, the NFL does not need to, in a sense, tacitly approve of this kind of thug celebration and, you know, this kind of lifestyle that they end up perpetuating. And I know a lot of people, including friends of mine, who just don't watch anymore for a lot of reasons. But we're already out of time for this morning, and we're going to have Matt Walsh on tomorrow promoting his new movie, Am I Racist? Go to amiracist.com. You can reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.